There is a disinformation program, literally, for everyone, no matter who you are and what your interests are, what your beliefs are, which way you're focusing. There is a website set up just for you to take you in and to vector your thinking and your attention into the way that they want you to think.
You are listening to Radio Free Signs of the Times, broadcasting into the heart of an occupied America.
Welcome to this week's Signs of the Times podcast. I'm Henry.
I'm Joe.
And I'm Scott.
We are back this week with John, who is a director of a major Eurozone bank. Welcome, John.
Good evening.
John was with us just about a year ago. It was in October. And we were talking about the economic situation. And that podcast has been one of our most popular podcasts. So we decided to bring John back and take a look at the economic apocalypse coming this year. All right, John?
Yeah, I last time I was very careful not to speculate about what was going to happen. And I think we need to be realistic about how things are going.
No, we just sat down and we listened to the podcast from last year, and we were worried that maybe we'd gotten carried away in dire predictions. And in fact, we were quite astonished at how careful we'd been, because you can't know what's going to come. You can't know when it's going to come. All you can do is look at the signs, as we keep saying. And we wanted to look kind of after a year at what's changed, what hasn't changed, and how the economy, why the economy has proven to be so resilient.
Well, this is one of the problems because, to be fair, last year, as you said, John, you were quite cagey and you weren't making any predictions, but you did say that there were a lot of signs and at that time, a lot of noises in the marketplace predicting certain things, and things certainly seemed to be on edge to some degree, which prompted us to do last year's kind of economic podcast discussing the potentials. How are the signs this year?
I think the thing that's really been learned in the last 10 months is, as you say, everybody was speculating last year, about this time last year, that the end of the economic system as we knew it must be nigh. And at the moment, it's obvious that the end is not nigh. It's certainly not nigh this week. And so when we look at that, it's made me ask a few fundamental questions as to the powers that be that are running the system. What drives them? What are going to be the criteria and the circumstances that are going to allow them the freedom to push the economic bus, as the analogy we used last year, over the edge? And I think that the revision to thinking is that perhaps that the time scales are extremely flexible. At the moment, they've been able to get away with pretty much what they want. They've got a world economic situation which is feeding their wars. They've got a basically compliant population. They've got in the three countries that seem to count for some reason, the United States, the UK, and Australia, a population that seems to genuinely believe in some form of Islamic terrorism. So where they're going is obviously a matter of some speculation.
I guess if you can get those people to believe in Islamic terrorism, you can get them to believe that the U.S. dollar is worth something.
Yeah, they've managed to do that for quite some time. And the U.S. dollar, as I think everybody knows, is a piece of paper with green ink on it. It is backed by nothing. How they maintain this illusion is a feat. It's an extraordinary feat. And I think it's to the maintenance of the illusion that perhaps we should be looking, because as long as illusion maintains, and as long as they can use that illusion to further their various nefarious ends, perhaps they don't need to drop the economy just yet. I still maintain that they do need to drop the economy in due course, and even if perhaps elements in the powers that be feel they can maintain the illusion, it is obvious when you look at it that the system is coming under strain. And it's the strain and the need for the illusion that are perhaps where we should be looking.
Well, as we talked about last year, you pretty much delineated the way that the kind of economies of individual countries and the global economy is entirely manipulated. I mean, there's a general perception among ordinary people that economies are something that are real, that are based on very real factors that are, you know, you can touch them kind of thing. But that's not the case, as we mentioned last year. So if it is, as you say, manipulated, then that obviously poses a problem as to predicting when the manipulation is going to change and they're going to manipulate it downwards. It's up to them, and as you just said, it's probably based on other factors in terms of, you mentioned, compliant population and maybe wars that are happening at that particular time.
Yeah, it is. I think there's a few things that have happened in the last 12 months that point to this continuing maintenance of the illusion, and the fact that they're having to use increasingly dramatic measures to maintain the illusion. And the first thing is the fact that the United States no longer publishes statistics on the amount of money it prints. Now, why would the world's biggest economy, with the world's greatest currency, as we're led to believe, the currency that is the currency of exchange of the entire globe, cease to tell us how much money it's printing? Well, there's only one reason for that, is they must be printing a lot more than they want us to know. So if you think that that dollar you've got in your pocket is one of, say, a few trillion in circulation, but if you were to find that they've actually printed another few trillion in the last 12 months, that dollar starts to become relatively worthless. I think that's a fundamental change that occurred on the 20th of March this year. They ceased to publish what's referred to as M3 money supply statistics. And the other, another thing that's going on is the increasing and continuing high levels of the oil price. And one area I think we should be looking at is what happens to petrodollars. What happens to that oil that is bought at $70, $75 a barrel? And the answer is that it goes into the pockets of governments in the form of taxation. It goes into the pockets of very, very large, usually American-controlled oil companies in the form of oil revenues. It goes into the national oil companies of the host country. That's the polite term for saying the rapee. Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, these countries are all being raped of their wealth, and the rapee has an oil company that is government-controlled. And then there are the governments themselves under what are called production-sharing agreements, where the government of a country gets a slice of the production of the oil wealth that comes out. Now, what do you do? You've got these various parties are holding on to U.S. dollars. They could put it in banks, one might speculate. But banks don't really want that sort of size of money. They've got plenty of money flowing around, and they've got nowhere to put it. So there's only one real home for spare U.S. dollars, if you keep them in U.S. dollars, and that's the United States Treasury. What does the United States Treasury do? It issues United States Treasury bills, and it gives the resulting funds, broadly speaking, to the Pentagon. And the Pentagon then builds missiles and bombs and ships.
Who does it issue these Treasury bills to?
They'd issue the Treasury bills. A bill is like a loan. It's a tradable loan certificate. They issue them to the governments and the oil companies and the people who have all these spare dollars. So basically, these people lend the money back to the United States government.
Well, there was talk a year ago about the fact that China was holding an awful lot of these, and there was speculation that some of these other foreign countries that had the U.S. Treasury bills weren't going to want to maintain such large U.S. dollar reserves in these bills. There were certain months, I recall, where the U.S. government was having trouble selling all of the bills that they wanted to sell in a month. What's happened in the last year on that?
Well, the central banks that were speculated about have continued, broadly speaking, to buy dollars, although in lesser quantities. Increasingly, they're moving their purchases into euro and some into yen, but primarily into euro. The statistics you'll have noticed have not been widely publicized because clearly if the central banks in the major economies with savings continue not to buy dollars, that's something that the world doesn't want to hear, that particularly the American population don't want to hear. The Bank of Korea, for example, froze its dollar accounts and now saves primarily in euro, although that was obviously caused a few problems. So the United States immediately announced the pullout of American troops from South Korea. So the South Koreans commenced buying dollars again, dollar debt. China has continued to buy dollars, but in reducing amounts. The game that goes on between China and the United States continues. It's a game of three-dimensional chess, I think. There's so many moving parts going on. The United States government tells the Chinese government they must revalue their currency because their currency is too cheap. However, if the Chinese government revalued their currency, then American citizens couldn't afford to buy Chinese junk and would have to face the fact that they're not really as wealthy as they feel that they are. And, of course, there's the longer game, which is China is clearly being set up as the economic scapegoat in the minds of the Americans. I think there was a survey sometime in about the last 3 or 4 months where the Americans said that they believed that China was the greatest economic threat and the greatest sort of power threat to them. Whereas if you actually go to China, they regard the United States as a bit of a joke, a place you can get some nice films, you can sell a lot of cheap goods. But frankly, they don't see the United States as a major strategic threat. China's growing. It's got 1.2 billion people. It's more than capable of looking after itself. It's very happy to sell its goods to the United States, but it can sell its goods elsewhere. The United States is just one big trading partner, and they know that the United States is on its way down, that it will not be a major world power. They see it in the next 50 years. And they're quite relaxed about that. Their biggest fear is that as the United States collapses, that it will actually thrash out, as many empires do.
Yeah.
The key savers of the world are not really the central banks. The key flows in terms of the people financing U.S. government debt are the people who are selling oil and the people who are involved in that chain of oil production, oil refining, oil selling, the final selling of petroleum products, so gasoline, that sort of thing. It is all those parties, so whether it's the U.S. government, other governments who collect taxes, companies that collect revenues. Companies often collect revenues, and then they're obviously taxed by governments or they're indeed owned by governments. It's where are these dollars going is the key. And where is the sensitivity of the United States government to where these dollars go? And the good example of sensitivity is the United States behavior towards Hugo Chavez, who produces a lot of oil. I believe he sells the United States 13% of its oil needs. But instead of being a good little compliant nation, Hugo Chavez does the absolutely outrageous and rebellious thing with his dollars. He spends them on his people. He doesn't lend them back to the United States. And to the extent that he needs them to trade, he either doesn't sell his oil in dollars at all to other nations. He trades in barter, in kind. Or where he sells to the United States and other major world nations that don't want to trade in kind, he takes those dollars, says thank you very much, sells them on the international currency market and gets something of more value, be it gold, euro, yen, other currencies for which he can trade. And this is a very significant thing that the United States really, really resents, because the dollar is like any commodity. As I said earlier, it's just a piece of paper printed with green ink. And if that piece of paper with green ink is not demanded so much, its value drops. And 13% of U.S. oil purchases is a very significant chunk of dollars. And to have that not recirculating back to the United States is clearly upsetting the United States government. And that has to be one of the reasons why they're going after Chavez. My view, and I think the view of a number of people looking at the situation, is that the reason the oil price is being pushed so high and maintained so high, there's no fundamental basis for it. There's plenty of oil available. The oil is still being pumped. Maybe the odd pipeline gets ruptured for a few days in Iraq, but the reality is oil is still flowing. There's no reason for high oil other than, without high oil, the American government would have to acknowledge the fact that it is now bankrupt.
So you're saying essentially that the the high oil price is essentially a way of supplementing for of America supplementing its income that it's maybe lost or losing from people like Chavez, or I don't know. I mean, if there's any other implications with other countries around the world who are doing something similar or trying to kind of screw over the American government in a similar economic way, but that this hike in oil prices is a direct, is possibly a, has a direct relationship with.
Keeps the demand on U.S. dollars.
It keeps the demand on dollars. If you push the oil price up, you double the oil price. It's a very significant part of global trade flows.
Mm.
And once you've done that, you've increased its share of the flow.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount demand for dollars remains high. Mm-hmm. And despite this massive demand for dollars, we've got a dollar sitting at around 126, 127 to the euro,
mm-hmm.
which is a long, long way from...
From what, you know, it should be.
It's a long way from what it should be. Personally, what it should be is somewhere else. One US dollar is probably worth something, you know, realistically. Well, how much would you pay for a piece of paper with green ink on it?
Yeah. I don't know. How much is toilet paper these days?
It's not very soft, and I'm not sure about its absorbent qualities.
Lower end of the market toilet paper, then.
There may be quite some demand if they actually print some notes with George Bush's face on it, though.
Mm. Be an upsurge in demand for dollars.
There might be, yeah, exactly. I think there's other aspects of why the situation is being maintained and how it's being maintained. And earlier we spoke about the illusion of economy. And just taking it rather closer to home, rather than looking at the global macroeconomic flows, what's actually happening on the street? How are people feeling? What are people actually noticing? And certainly where I live in Asia, we're seeing a number of things happening. First of all, salaries have been frozen for many years. In fact, salaries are often dropping, and those people who are suffering salary drops are being told that, don't worry, it'll be fine, because when the company does well, it'll come back in your bonus, or we've given you some shares in the company, and that compensates you for the fact that you're not being paid so much. Well, I can give you shares in a company if anybody would like to buy some. I can probably sell you some of those as well. The reality is that salaries and the fixed cost of labor is being reduced, and this is something that people are noticing. To compensate for this, a number of people, a lot of people who perhaps have previously had maybe one working member of a household now have two working members of a household. Perhaps people who've had two working members of a household are now having to consider an additional work. Perhaps one of those people is having to work two jobs.
Selling the kids
in Asia is quite profitable. I understand that there's quite a significantly large organization. Its name begins with M, who run quite a significant business headquartered in the Middle East. Also within work, I think people are seeing the work demands are going up. And this may seem rather small, but how many people are... around you or you yourself realize that you're going into work a bit earlier and that what you're being asked to do is more and you're leaving a bit later and you're just a bit more stressed by the whole situation. This is happening across the board, but you're being paid less for it, effectively. And then what do you do when you've got that dollar in your pocket or that pound in your pocket or that euro in your pocket? You go out and you find that rent or the purchasing power of your money from property has reduced. Properties just are so expensive.
But this is where banks come in, because I know what you're talking about, because I have concrete kind of real-world examples from people I know where, particularly in the housing market, where house prices have gone up significantly in a lot of places. Even here where we are in France, I mean, house prices over the past few years have steadily increased. But people, as you say, aren't getting paid anymore, so it's harder for them to do this, to make these purchases. But this is where banks come in, is it not? Because at the same time, as I've noticed this, I've noticed that banks have been pushing loans on people. Even people who 10 years ago would have been interrogated before they were given a loan by a bank manager are now being encouraged to take one. So, that solves the problem, supposedly.
Well, it seems to solve the problem, but I remember when I first bought a house, I was told very, very sagely by the bank manager that I could borrow 2.5 times my salary, and that was it. There was no negotiation. And yet today in the UK, you can borrow six times your salary. In Singapore, you can borrow 9 or 10 times your salary. In Hong Kong, the same. In Japan, you can borrow for 50 years. You can actually leave a mortgage in your will. Hello, kiddies. Thanks very much. It was really nice knowing you. And by the way, here's a shitload of debt. It's an extraordinary situation. Banks have just been playing this game.
But could that be seen as one of our potential signs of something going to change, a major shift? Because what we're really saying there is that people are being forced into debt, more and more debt. They get a house now still, even at the inflated prices, but essentially they own less of that house, or maybe none of that house at all, and they owe a lot more to the bank. And, I mean, if this is happening across the board and a lot of people are going into more and more debt and are being forced into more and more debt by this set of circumstances that you're describing, I mean, if there's an economic collapse and jobs are lost and income is lost, you know, the bank owns everything, right? The bank owns you and it owns more and more people. So, I mean, I don't know. That's just a speculation. Again, we're not into, you know, kind of giving any kind of predictions, but...
Well, the bank does own you. I don't think you necessarily need to look at sort of very significant economic changes. Imagine an economy whose activity drops by 5%. That means it was a $100 billion economy, and it becomes a $95 billion economy. That means there's $5 billion not circulating in that economy. Now, naturally, that means that there's a percentage of people who are not going to be working. Mm-hmm. If those people aren't working, they don't have any money. They can't pay the mortgage. So what happens? The bank comes along and says, thank you very much. We really enjoyed lending you that money. Now you can't pay us that money. And in the UK, there are revised bankruptcy laws. In the United States, there are new bankruptcy laws, came in about 2 years ago, that enable the bank to evict you. And they will just simply come in and say, you cannot afford the debt. Thank you very much. Very nice property. See you around. And it's not going to take a great deal for that to happen. And I think that there's the inflation that's going on in property. There's the inflation in rents, of course, because that's the other alternative. And one thing I would suggest to anybody is if you've got a property that's very, 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 very valuable and a large, large, large debt, if those two are currently equal, I'd suggest you sell, get rid of the debt. Hmm. But other things relating to inflation, other prices are increasing. I think most of us go to the supermarket and realize that it's costing us a lot more to walk through that checkout each week. We go to the gas station, and clearly oil prices have pushed up gas prices. But pretty much whatever you want to do, it's gone up. You want to get in an aeroplane, and unless it's EasyJet at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're going to pay a fair amount for that. Everything is much more expensive, yet we're told that inflation across most major economies is only about 2-2.5%. Yet we all know that's a complete lie. Mm. So people are under economic pressure, and as you say, they've been borrowing more money. So you have to ask yourself, why? Why would the system allow this to happen?
But historically, is this something that has happened before? Is this something that goes in cycles? I mean, you know, we're saying that the cost of living is going up. Salaries to finance that new or higher cost of living are not increasing to match it, and the banks are stepping in to finance this higher cost of living. So the bank is owning a larger and larger part of your life in terms of what your wealth. But is this something that kind of ebbs and flows in terms of will it reduce again? And I mean, has it happened in the past? Or?
Yeah, this is kind of an important question, I think, because a lot of people will, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people and I've sort of relay some of this data to them, and they say, well, you know, it's just a cycle and the same thing happened before, you know, the high oil prices went up and housing prices went up and then it just went back down again. And so I think many people aren't really doing anything, especially in the US, because it's just the cycle, and yeah, it might get bad, but it'll get better again. And so what's your take on that?
My take is that would be wonderful if it was true. Never before in the history of modern economics have we ended up with the extreme situation that we have today. Never before have we had the single greatest economy in the world, and that is the United States, essentially bankrupt, borrowing far more money than it can ever hope to service, pay off you know, even pay the interest in a generation. That is one extreme. Never before have we had so much consumer debt. I mean, that's the debt that each of us holds on our credit cards, on our auto loans, and as we've been talking on houses. Never before have people been able to borrow so much money. In the Great Depression in the United States, and which rippled across Europe, most people rented property. If you have an economy where 70 or 80% of the people rent property, you can be a landlord. You can ask $400 for an apartment a week, but if there's nobody there to pay it, you'll settle for $100. But now in the United States, over 70% of people own their own property officially. That's the legal title, is officially with them. Now, of course, the economic title is with a bank. But that's going to be a new situation that the world has never seen before. Economic crises where people are going to be thrown out of properties unless there is a reason why the banks are going to be persuaded not to. And again, this, I think, is going to come to the illusion. If it suits the powers that be, and I think it will suit them, as things do start to get worse, and I think the last time we were discussing that maybe the bus being driven fast off the cliff was the analogy. It might be the case that they're not going to drive the bus fast off the cliff. It's going to be like going down a set of stairs. It's going to be little bumps at a time. And each time there's a bump, yes, sure, there'll be victims. But who knows who those victims are going to be? Is it going to be the comfortable middle class or the blue-collar production line worker?
Well, we know who it's not going to be, right?
It's not going to be George and his friends.
As you're talking about that, it comes to mind that it could be used again as another form of control, and the banks and the governments can go to people who are starting to default on their mortgage payments, and if the banks may not want to get all of this property, where, you know, what's the bank going to do with it? But it becomes a way to say to people, okay, if you want to stay in your house, well, this is what you got to do.
It does. I mean, many countries, including the United States, mortgages are insured by the United States government. In the U.S., it's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the insurance providers. Those are government agencies. Maybe it is a way of getting people into a position where you can control them. Perhaps if you give up your eldest son for the service of the great nation, we'll send him to Iran or Syria or some other place where we're fighting our latest war.
Makes sense. Because, you know, you send them off and they come home in a box and that's one less mouth to feed, right?
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be an overt kind of coercive manipulation. It's done as a, you know, if you have a member in the military, then the government will meet your mortgage or, you know, whatever. So it can be done almost as a gift so that the manipulative aspect of it is hidden. Just to keep people in line.
Something we didn't do last time, which I'd like to get into. Speculation. Not prophecy, not prediction.
At the time already.
Not prophecy, not prediction, or speculation. Basically,
you've got something you want to invest?
Yeah. Market speculation. No. In terms of, we're talking about an potential economic collapse. How would it happen? Potentially. An example. What would possibly push it over the edge? And would it fall all the way? Are there levels to which it can fall? Or if it falls, does it go all the way to the bottom? I mean, you mentioned the stairs, bump, 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 bump. But how would it happen?
That's a extremely difficult question.
Yeah.
The question, I think, relies on which leg of the illusion fails. And obviously to speculate on that is extremely difficult. This time last year, I'd have told you that the scenario was that the United States dollar would fail. It is a failed currency. Everything has been set up. At the time, we knew that they were going to stop publishing these statistics about how much money they were printing. Now, every logical person, I think, when they look at a currency, for example, I think if the Japanese government said it was going to stop telling anybody what the hell was going on inside Japan, the yen would collapse. And there would be sort of, you know, some sort of flight to some form of quality. The United States has got away with just saying, well, we don't really need to tell you, you know, how much money we're printing.
Mm-hmm.
So I just suggested that the dollar would collapse,
mm-hmm.
that would drive U.S. companies into extremely difficult positions. It would then cause a ripple effect across the global economy.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd start to then see that international trade would start to collapse because the trade systems work as long as you've got stability. You can have a currency that's collapsing by 5% a month, but as long as it's continuing to collapse by 5% a month, people can adjust. It's high degrees of volatility. It's a bit like a ship. If you put into a very, very rough sea with lots of twisting and bending, eventually it breaks apart. Yet if you put into big, big swelling seas, as long as there's not the twisting and bending, it'll survive very well. And I think it's going to be the volatility. It's going to be the extreme stresses that would break the system.
What would cause the dollar to collapse?
Everybody suddenly realizing how useless it was. It's a lack of economies of confidence things.
Mm-hmm.
The key thing that backs the U.S. dollar is the confidence that the United States will continue to function. It will continue to pay the interest, and that there's nowhere else to put the money. Now, one of the things that may be developing is that there's just basically a lack of choice. Europe is trying, relatively speaking, not to borrow as much as the United States. So you've got the U.S. is demanding all this money. It's a good home. It's paying generous interest rates. I mean, 2 years ago, interest rates were down at sort of the 2% level. They're now at the 5% level. Not high historically, but high relatively.
Mm-hmm.
It's the illusion of continuity that is absolutely crucial. I think the thing that will probably break it is not going to be an economic thing. I think something will come out about the events on that have been going on the face of this planet in the last few years. Something will come out about the illusory nature of the war on terror. Something will come out about what the real role, perhaps, of Israel in certain global events has been. Something will come out about the real situation in terms of the supply of food on the planet. Maybe something will be manipulated. Maybe they'll deliberately push the system with a bird flu pandemic. Something will cause a massive loss in confidence. We had an interesting situation in May, June this year, when the value of debt instruments, the value of bonds in the international market collapsed. And a number of speculators suggested this was it. This was the beginning. This was the first big drop in the staircase. We've seen property values drop 4% or 5% in some areas of the United States, some areas of the United Kingdom. And the feeling was that perhaps this was it. This was that the international markets had last realized that these companies couldn't pay their debts, that some of the very highly structured methods for borrowing money were no longer viable. Bang, this was it. And a lot of people, you know, sort of ran for the window.
It's interesting that you talk about confidence because, I mean, it's almost like you're saying that as long as something like you're describing doesn't come out about that negatively affects world perception of America, that things can continue. But if it does happen, if America's image or something comes out like you're describing, that it would be mere sentiment that would. But that kind of posits that. I mean, who are these people who will be feeling this? You know, this, you talk about sentiment, it's feeling. I mean, we're talking about major, high-level world government level here, right? And I would kind of, being conspiratorially minded, I would assume that, just a little bit conspiratorially minded, that I would assume that these people at this level around the world,
they
know what America, if America's got a secret, they know what the secret is. But maybe it's that you're saying that, you know, okay, we'll keep your secret as long as no one knows. But as soon as it's exposed, I'm sorry, we don't want to touch you with a barge pole type thing. You know, you've got leprosy now, you know what I mean? Get away, you know? And, I mean, is that the level that we're talking at?
If I could answer that question, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd have a very substantial mansion in the United States somewhere, and I'd be one of them.
Okay.
And so far they haven't invited me into the club. It's probably the company I keep. It's a good question. It's a good question. The illusion in question. Who believes? The reality is that the currency traders in the world's banks are the people who push markets around on a daily basis, but they are able to be manipulated by, as we mentioned last time, things like plunge protection and for various other market manipulation mechanisms. And this may be the reason why we haven't seen the fundamental collapse that we would reasonably speculate would occur, is that indeed on some level these people are all working together. And I think there's an interesting example, which I still haven't worked out, which is Iran is being told that unless it complies with a series of completely illusory demands based on the fact that it doesn't have a nuclear program, but it has to prove it doesn't have it. Proving a negative, by the way, is illegal under common law, so it's interesting that this is the process that the United Nations is proposing to impose on Iran. That Iran, this country that supplies so much oil to the rest of the world, that has so much, therefore, fundamental economic power, doesn't go and tell the United States to go and stuff it. At what level are these people operating? I mean, it's, have this sort of the big boys been told, look, you know, there's a nice underground bunker for you in Philadelphia or somewhere? I mean, who knows? I mean, if I was the Iranian president, the first thing I'd be doing is opening my doors to all nuclear inspection. I'd be publicizing massively the realities of my nuclear program. I'd be selling all my oil in euros, and I'd be subsidizing other people to do the same. I would refuse to sell any oil to the United States of America. I'd be finding alternative markets. And I would point out that I controlled the Straits of Hormuz. And I'd be exacting a toll on all ships that were destined for the United States. And I'd be playing those cards, except they're not playing them. So exactly, what maintains this system? And I think this is a situation we all find ourselves in, which is rather odd. You know, China even seems to play the game. You know, the United States gets up and says, oh, China, you know, the evil panda.
Human rights and
all. Oh, human rights, absolutely. I mean, China can imprison a few people, and it's dreadful human rights. America can do the same, and it's a war on terror. We haven't seen very many pictures, have we, of Iraq has been crushed by American tanks?
No.
Yes, Tiananmen Square is the image that was in my mind.
Yeah,
But we don't see those pictures.
We don't see those, no.
So how it all works, how it's all interconnected, is extremely difficult. The other day, I was speaking to a friend, and they said that they found two economies particularly interesting. They were the economies of Dubai and Singapore. Now, you look at these two places, and I mean, no disrespect to two extraordinary governments who've managed to take economic illusion to the ultimate degree. Both of them are... They're both tiny places with people. That's all they've got. And out of these people, they have managed to create these massive economies, which have these extraordinary, I mean, Singapore's government reserves make it per capita the richest nation on the planet. Dubai has something in the region of 15 or 20% of the world's tower cranes operating, building. And neither of these countries has any natural resources whatsoever. So you have to ask, how are these economies built? What is it these economies do that allows world powers, and ultimately, you know, we are talking about world powers, allow economies to succeed? What is it they do? What are these flows that they facilitate? Sure, on the face of it, there are certain trade flows that, I mean, Singapore is the gateway to Asia if you're coming anywhere from the West. Dubai is perhaps the gateway to the Middle East. It's awfully close to the fallout cloud from Israel, if you ask me. But you know, how it all works is becoming increasingly difficult to see, because, you know, if you're a trained economist, you say, well, when I look at supply and demand and economic pressures, and America is a drunk man who has borrowed too much money, who can never pay it back, who is out of control with a bundle of weapons, high on the most extraordinarily intoxicating drugs, you'd never lend a dime to that sort of person. Yet people continue to support the American economy. It's unbelievable. And you go to other countries. I mean, you go to countries where people actually produce things. They really grow real food that's really nutritious. They actually make things that people really want. And yet when they want to borrow money, it's, well, yes, we might be able to do a little deal with the IMF, but in order to do it, you've got to shut 10 hospitals, put another 20,000 people out of work, and allow your ports and your airport to be sold to XYZ, PLC, or Inc., which just happens, remarkably, to be owned by the developing world. So none of it fits together. it boggles the mind as to how this system maintains its illusory nature. And I think the thing that I'm really starting to grapple with is, last time when we spoke, I was looking at it as a sort of almost a theoretical thing, saying that this system, the theories that govern this system, have to be coming to their end. The tension in this material is getting to the point where we're going to suffer metal fatigue. All the elastic bands are going to snap, the metal's going to twist and rip apart, everything's got to fail. But it's not failing. And it really does raise a fundamental question: what's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point about the and very true about when you talk about countries that actually produce something of some value, you know, nutritious food, products that people actually need, and these countries are subjected to the worst kind of economic treatment, or the harshest economic treatment, whereas other countries, like, as you mentioned, Dubai and Singapore, that by and large produce the frills of capitalist societies, they are awash in cash. And I mean, we can see a parallel to that, or how that translates down to the individual level, because in Western capitalist countries, or capitalist countries around the world, more and more people are spending their money on things they don't need, on nothing, on illusion. I know of someone in, as an example, in Dubai. You mentioned Dubai. Someone in Dubai who provides a product. He has his own company, and he provides a product which is essentially presentations for companies that want to, a company that will have its annual general meeting or wants to have a large conference for customers, and he provides the presentations, essentially, like the PowerPoint presentations. And he does very, very little work. I mean, he pushes a couple of buttons on his laptop computer and makes things happen. And he charges what are, for the ordinary person, inordinate sums of money. So there's all this money coming to him and coming, and he's just a small example. There's people above him that generate much greater incomes, but equally based on providing nothing, really, nothing of any value. And that's been inflated and inflated and inflated. So you have large numbers of billions of people in the world who have nothing in these countries that could produce something. Maybe like you think of Africa and people who people who are essentially starving, and other people in capitalist countries, as I say, who are providing services that are of no value to anyone, really. And it's like you mentioned, it's almost like it'll be inflated to the point where the bubble must burst, this illusory bubble.
Well, perhaps this is where we should be sort of focusing our attention. The end game is perhaps to create these extraordinary levels of distortion, extraordinary wealth in the hands of a very, very small number of people, and extraordinary poverty on the backs of the vast majority of people. And we've seen this very successfully achieved over a number of years. The chief weapon of choice at the moment is the IMF and the World Bank. Any organization that says its primary aim is the alleviation of poverty and then allows Paul Wolfowitz to serve on its board has to be Machiavellian in the extreme. So we must assume, and obviously look at the record of the World Bank, its single greatest success is the creation of poverty across the globe. And perhaps this is it. Perhaps that this is an extraordinarily dynamic system. If they can create what they want, which seems to be this massive economic distortion, they don't need to create a crash. They just need to twist and push. And this distortion, we were talking previously about house prices and people's debt. If you've loaded people up with this debt and they have nowhere to go, you own everything. You own the house, you own their car, you own everything they have. And they haven't had the wherewithal to listen to Signs of the Times economic podcast and consider the realities of the world, or indeed read the website and consider the realities of the world. They're a prisoner, and they can be pushed around and pushed down, and their salaries can be depleted, and their economic freedom is, well, they don't have any economic freedom, but their illusion of economic freedom can be taken away from them very, very rudely. If that can be done without major crisis and the system can maintain, then if I was the wizard behind the curtain, you don't need drama. If you can do this sort of gently and twisting. And this has been done quite successfully. I mean, one of the most successful economies in Latin America 10 years ago was the economy of Argentina. And, you know, Argentina went through a crisis. Savings were wiped out, the destruction of the middle classes, the impoverishment of the working classes. And now you've got a situation where the wealth of Argentina is still as it was. I mean, it's a very wealthy country. But even fewer people own it now. And large chunks of it are now owned by international corporations. And the IMF is still telling... It was actually very annoyed. There was quite an interesting comment by somebody from the IMF that Argentina had been incredibly irresponsible paying all its IMF debt back when it couldn't really afford it. Which was a sort of, to my mind, was a way of saying Argentina didn't play the game. We didn't get to screw them quite hard enough. Mm-hmm. You know, they sort of understood what was going on. It's interesting because there's an IMF meeting coming up on the running from the 10th to the 20th of September. And clearly it's a contentious organization. It's done a lot of things in the last few years that have attracted a lot of opposition. And if you're going to hold an IMF conference, one of the best places you can hold it, just to ensure there's no opposition and it's a very smooth, nice conference, would be somewhere like Singapore, and that's exactly where it's being held. And I do wonder if perhaps it is being held in Singapore, which was a location that was chosen a number of years ago, with an understanding that they'd need somewhere safe where there was going to be no protest, where newspapers will only cover what the IMF does if there are burning tires in the streets, if there are riot police on the streets. In Singapore, there'll be a number of orchids around, a number of nice trips out into the surrounding region. The weather's excellent. The food is superb. It's a very peaceable country. There'll be no demonstrations, not because nobody objects to the IMF, but because it's illegal to demonstrate. It's a well-chosen location, and therefore there'll be nothing to cover. So there'll be no debate. There'll be no consciousness in the public mind that what is this organization, what does it do, how does it contribute to this balance of economic power. So perhaps this is what's going to happen. We're being fed lies daily by CNN and the BBC, and I won't even mention, you know, other news channels that just feed people complete rubbish. And maybe this is it. Maybe it's just all it is the illusion is just going to be maintained and maintained and maintained, and it doesn't need a crash. It just needs twisting and bending. And if you tell people that inflation is 2.5%, despite the fact that they know that they're buying, you know, 10 or 15% less with that salary, they'll say, oh, well, inflation is only 2.5%. And, you know, it must be me. Maybe I'm going out too much or something. I mean, whatever it is they sort of do to self-calm themselves. And maybe that's it. Maybe there isn't going to be some dastardly crash. But it's still going to leave every person who earns a salary in the position that they would be in as if there had been a crash. It's going to be worth less. If you're an American citizen and the US dollar becomes worth its real value, which is, as we would like to say in England, two-fifths of fuck all, then you won't be able to do anything. You won't be able to buy anything anyway. You're going to be completely beholden to the United States, which, by the way, is a country that doesn't even produce enough food to feed itself. Maybe that's where it's going to go. I don't know.
All of this is very far removed from the average person in terms of, we're talking about the IMF and the global economy and the people that pull the strings. And obviously none of us sitting here or anybody else that's listening to this or anyone else in the world really can do anything about it. They can't change it. They can't protest, especially not in Singapore or America these days.
Or Britain.
Or Britain.
Within a kilometre of Tony Blair.
Yeah. Increasing number of places, but that's another issue. But, last year you talked about, you gave some pointers as to what people could actually do. And, I mean, we had to get in the fact that, the point that we have repeatedly made, which is very important for people to come to terms with, which is that you essentially are screwed. You are being screwed, and you're going to be screwed more. That alone, I suppose, it can be a catalyst for doing something, but the doing is going to be at a personal level. Is there anything that people can actually do, or is it just enough for them to say, oh, look, you know, I'm being completely manipulated financially, I'm being screwed financially in every which way. That's nice, you know.
You've talked about people who might have houses and debt, and they can sell their houses and pay off their debt. But there are a lot of people who don't have houses. There are a lot of people that don't have mutual funds. There are a lot of people that don't have any gold and don't have the funds to purchase the gold.
What to do? If you're just an ordinary person, you rent a property. You earn a salary, maybe have a car. You don't have all these fancy things. I think you have to try and work out what it is you're doing and what your level of flexibility is. And I think the single greatest thing you can do is to work out who your real friends are, who your real family are, if you know what I mean, and start to work together. It's only through collective work, working together. In Western societies, we've been so conditioned to be separate and be independent. And in fact, independence is our greatest motto in many ways. You know, you're 18, on that 18th birthday, your parents give you two things. You know, they give you some sort of, I mean, Bruce Springsteen, a wedding coat, said, they give you something and then they kick you out of the house. And they tell you, wonderful, there you are, you're a man, or you're a grown girl now, out you go. You go and fend for yourself in the world. As I mentioned, I actually live in Asia, and the Asians take a very different view. You stay at home, and you know, if there's a family business, you work in the family business, and you try and grow things collectively. And it might mean having to live with your mother-in-law or your grandmother, but they get round it. And that's something I think in the West we really need to consider. We only have real power if we act collectively. If you're renting a property and you've got a couple of kids who've got their own places and they're renting and they're doing a regular job, and you know, maybe you've got a brother or a sister, consider working together, or maybe you've got some friends, work together, work out what you can do. Maybe the price of a bigger place to live together is going to be less than the sum of all the places that you're currently renting. If you've got, you know, three cars between you, maybe you only need two. If you are able to work together in some way, it's the simple things. It's the extraordinarily simple things. Work together. Work out what it is you're going to need. Work out what your flexibilities are. If you think you're in a job that's at high risk, think about what you're going to do now. What can I do? You speak English. Don't forget that there's people out there who really value the fact you speak English. There are countries out there who will employ you if you can, you know, consider what you might do outside the country, or outside your state, or outside your town. Think of the wider world. Think of what you can do together. As a family or a group of friends, you might have something you can do that people would highly value, and they'll value it at more than $5.50 an hour.
Do you think it's valuable for people to imagine a worst case scenario where, for example, their house is repossessed by the bank, they've lost their job, and they have little income? What would they do in that situation? Put themselves in that position and think, what would I do? Where would I go? Maybe even throw in, you know, food being in limited supply, you know, supermarkets few and far between. What would you do?
I think the difficulty is that starts to sort of naturally push one to the, as I said last time, I don't go into the woods in America much, to sort of meet the guys with the M60 and the year's supply of rice and, lots of books about Vietnam or something. I think what you do is you have to be practical. Look at what happened in Katrina. Look what the U.S. government did. They didn't actually do anything to support the most vulnerable people. They actually made the most vulnerable people, they criminalized them for their desire to survive. They put them into the stadium, which the stories that were coming out of there were pretty horrific. They put armed patrols on the street. They've done nothing. And then now most of the media attention is gone, and you'd have thought that the most powerful government in the world, a government that can spend over $300 billion murdering a few hundred thousand Iraqis and stealing a country's oil wealth, could at least spend a few billion dollars of that on looking after its own people, it's very apparent that they have no interest in you whatsoever. So the answer to the question is with another question, which is, what is your neighborhood like? Where are your friends? What can you do together? You're only going to survive the worst circumstances if you work together. Running isn't going to necessarily work for everybody. However, consider where you're from. Many people in the United States are very proud of their immigrant background. If you come from a country that perhaps allows the fact that you can hold a passport because your grandparents were born there, maybe an Irish passport would be a very useful thing to have, or an Italian passport, or a Greek passport, or indeed a passport from wherever else your family may have come. Or maybe just an American passport. You know, Americans are still allowed to travel. You might be able to leave the country freely. I wouldn't suggest taking a copy of the Quran or wearing anything on your head, but you can still travel freely. If you can't travel, if the idea of leaving the United States is too much, if you feel you've got too many responsibilities, just consider really getting yourself into a position which is completely un-Western. Start living with the people around you. Start actually looking around you and saying, who are the people who I live next to? Do I have anything in common with these people? What can I do together? Because
people you can trust, right?
People you can trust. People who are not going to walk in your house and shoot you to get whatever you have, but are actually going to work with you to protect what you have. It's not a matter of running away. These events, as I say, the economic stress situation that causes the final fracturing in a society. Last time I made the comment about quoting Kissinger, that's when he said in 1992 at the Bilderberg Group that if you put the soldiers on the streets of Los Angeles today, the people of Los Angeles would rise up in rebellion. But if you created the right situation, they would beg you to put soldiers on the street. Picture that situation, American soldiers on the street. Now, you've seen them. They wear black. They wear gas masks. They look like SWAT teams. Those people that are currently glorified in movies, they're coming to get you if there's an economic collapse. And if you're too damn hungry and too damn desperate and you decide to take the law into your own hands, they're going to be there to stop you. So that's clearly not an option because you're going to get stopped. So work out what you can do. Work together. I know it's a complete anathema to most of us, but actually start to see the things you have in common with people rather than seeing the things which those people represent as threats. It may sound rather philosophical, but frankly, if that's the situation you're in, we are each other's only hope. And one final point. If you go out a lot, you go out to nightclubs, you have a good night out, maybe play a game of golf, maybe go and shoot some pool. Consider the value of being well-informed. Consider taking one of those nights out, maybe 50, 100 bucks a week, whatever it is you spend, maybe 50, 100 bucks a month, and consider donating it to signsofthetimes.org. Because sources like Signs of the Times, and I'm serious here, sources like Signs of the Times will give you the ability to see the world situation. But I've visited these guys, and I can tell you that they live on pretty much sod all. And what they're doing and the ability to tell you what's going on in the world is extremely important. And they cannot continue to do it. They cannot continue to have a bigger voice and a more important effect without money. And frankly, for the amount of money you spend on a night out, wouldn't it be better to spend that money and continue to look at the website, continue to hear podcasts, continue to get more services from people who actually care, people who actually have a care in the world about you and care what happens to you and care what happens to you, the face of this planet, rather than spending it out going in and getting drunk and forgetting about the horrors of going to work every day and the fact that your government is a murderous, genocidal government that supports policies around the world which are completely against the benefits and interests of most of the people on this planet.
And on that note, that banknote maybe, we will say goodbye for this week. We'd like to thank John for coming by again, and hopefully we'll be having him back to continue these discussions in the future.
It may be post-economic collapse or pre-economic collapse again.
Or
time will tell. That would be exciting. Mid would be a doozy, yeah.
Yeah, the pre-tribulationists, the post-tribulationists.
If you'd like to support the work that we're doing at Signs of the Times, you can click on the subscription image, which is in the right-hand column of the Signs page, and that will take you to a page where you can subscribe for a small monthly amount, a large monthly amount if you'd like. If every reader of the Science page or listener of our podcasts would donate just 10 euros a month, which is, I mean, when you go to a soda machine and you pay like $2.50 for a can of Coke, you know, we're asking for 4 cans of Coke a month. That's 1 can of Coke a week. And if every one of our readers and listeners could donate that amount, we would be able to expand our operation. We would be able to provide even greater coverage of the news that really matters. And we wouldn't have to have any annoying fundraisers. So thank you for any support you can provide. And that's it for this week. If you'd like to discuss tonight's topic or any other topic, you can visit the Signs of the Times forum, which is linked off of the Signs page at signs-of-the-times.org. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.